This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture. I'm PJ Thump and I'm a historian from the University of Oxford. And this is the history of Singapore. Episode 43, Operation Cold Storm, Part 1, The Night of Long Knives. On 21st July 1961, 13 People's Action Party assemblymen were expelled from the party. They had abstained on a motion of confidence in the government. This action finally precipitated a split between the left and right wings of the PAP. Around two-thirds of the party membership, including 35 of 51 branches and 19 of 23 organizing secretaries, resigned with the 13 assemblymen. On 29th July, they formed the new party, the Barisan Socialists, or Malay for Socialist Front. They saw themselves as the legitimate heirs of the PAP, which had been hijacked and taken astray by a right-wing leadership, and vowed to continue the struggle against colonialism and for the achievement of an independent, non-communist, socialist Malaya. Lim Chin Siong was elected Secretary General. The leaders of the Federation of Malaya were shocked and terrified. They had been told that Singapore was on the verge of a communist and Chinese chauvinist takeover. Now it looked like it was happening in front of their eyes, and they could not do anything about it. Alarmed by the defeat of the PAP at the Anson by-election, the formation of the Barisan Socialists, and the crumbling position of Singapore Prime Minister Lee Kuan Yew, Federation leaders demanded that Singapore's opposition be arrested, and arrested now. To force action, Federation Prime Minister Tunku Abdul Rahman served 6 months' notice that he would be withdrawing his representative from the Internal Security Council. He cited Lee Kuan Yew's actions as the reason. Lee Kuan Yew had used the Internal Security Council as cover for his continued incarceration of political detainees. He had privately urged the Internal Security Council to keep them locked up, while publicly blaming the British and Federation leaders for forcing him to keep them locked up. Most egregiously, in August 1959, Lee had deliberately introduced a document into the council recommending the release of political detainees, then in the next meeting asked for his own document to be vetoed so that he would keep his hands clean. Then in July 1961, he broke the council's cardinal rule of secrecy by tabling the document in the Legislative Assembly. Without mentioning, he had been the one to ask for the document to be vetoed, of course. So the Tunku was sick and tired and highly offended by Lee's lies and duplicity and by having to take all the blame for Lee's actions. A Security Council without the Federation would remove Lee Kuan Yew's ability to blame continued detentions on the Federation of Malaya. But, the Tunku said, the Federation would stay on in the council if the leaders of Singapore's opposition were arrested by the Singapore government. He argued that if Lee was telling the truth about an imminent communist takeover, then surely there should be no problem in arresting them on security grounds right away. Indeed, with the emergency only recently over, people would understand. But privately, Federation Deputy Prime Minister Tun Abdul Razak and Minister for Internal Security Dr. Ismail felt the real problem was Lee Kuan Yew, who had put everything into jeopardy with his irrational and dangerous actions. They also suspected that the British were deliberately allowing the situation in Singapore to worsen in order to force the Federation to take Singapore without the Borneo states. But mindful of their colonial reputation, the British refused to act unless they could justify it to the UK Parliament and the United Nations. The central issue was that the leaders of the Barisan Socialists had not broken any laws. They had not done anything illegal. Sure, the British believed the Barisan leaders to be communists, but they had not done anything illegal. They had no evidence for anything illegal. And even if they had evidence that, say, the Barisan leaders believed in communism, well, it was not illegal to be a communist in Singapore. What was illegal was the Malayan Communist Party. And membership of an illegal society carried a $3,000 fine and or 3 years imprisonment. But no one, not even Lee Kuan Yew or the Tunku, disputed the fact that the Barisan leaders were not members of the Communist Party. They only argued that the Barisan leaders were communists, believed in communism, and would pose a threat to British interests if they won the next election and took power. But without outright proof of subversion or illegal action, arresting the Barisan leadership would be globally construed as an attempt to silence legitimate opposition, as an attempt at neo-imperialism. Of course, the Tunku said, that should be no problem. If they are communists, just arrest them. Who needs evidence? You didn't worry about evidence during the Malayan emergency. But times had changed. The British needed proof, and they had none. Privately, British officials also complained that the Tunku was applying a double standard. He had left socialist members of his own parliament untouched, and before 1961 had never backed up British Commissioner Lord Selkirk in the Internal Security Council when Selkirk pushed Lee to take a tougher line with the left-wingers in the PAP. When you don't have to take responsibility for the consequences, you can be very brave and bold. But more than that, Lord Selkirk believed that the arrest was simply unnecessary. It was an unnecessary risk. The constitutional process was inexorably moving Singapore towards merger, towards Malaysia, with the Tunku having directed the Singapore Alliance to vote with the PAP, quote, when necessary to hold situation, unquote. The PAP had a rock-solid majority in the Legislative Assembly on crucial votes. The PAP had 26 seats and the Alliance had 7. The Barisan had only 13 assemblymen. As long as the Barisan adhered to constitutional methods, they could not win a vote and merger would happen regardless. If they got frustrated and resorted to illegal activity, they would be arrested. Either way, there would be no need to sully the already damaged British reputation by using detention without trial. Selkirk thus played for time and strenuously worked to keep all sides talking. He held off the Tunku's threat to leave the Internal Security Council by arguing that any arrest now would likely be seen as trying to fix the outcome of the parliamentary vote on the merger white paper in the Singapore Legislative Assembly. We discussed this vote last week. Privately, Selkirk and his deputy, Philip Moore, believed that the Federation leadership were also motivated by more straightforward political concerns. The UMNO leadership feared the consequences of a left-wing Barisan government rallying together Malaysia's non-Malays with progressive Malays to form a majority that could demand equality for all citizens, undermining UMNO's political supremacy. The Tunku openly worried at Lim Chin Siong's, quote, frightening organizational abilities and talismanic presence and the extremely skillful, successful and devoted, unquote, Barisan leadership. Their arrest on security grounds before the creation of Malaysia would solve his fear. Lee Kuan Yew, of course, was happy to acquiesce in the arrest of his political opponents. However, he recalled how Lim Yew Hock had destroyed his party's support and legitimacy by sanctioning arrests back in 1956. So Lee argued that they should be conducted after merger, when the federal government would bear responsibility. So in this vein, Lee Kuan Yew continued to insist that Singapore was on the verge of toppling over into communist-inspired disaster, while simultaneously declaring himself incapable of doing anything about it. The Tunku, of course, thought this was ridiculous. Lee was the prime minister of his country. If he could not do anything about it, then who could? So it took strenuous British efforts to convince the Federation to keep working with Lee. The British argued that Lee's fall would lead to a more left-wing government in Singapore. But the Federation leaders countered that the British would never allow such a government to take power. They were wrong. Privately, the British felt that as long as the government won power peacefully and constitutionally, they would have no choice but to allow it to take power. For the sake of merger, however, the Tunku agreed that his government would not do anything to jeopardize Lee's position as long as merger remained possible, and Lee did, quote, nothing stupid, unquote. Because you see, from their point of view, that was not a given. But to be safe, Selkirk quietly wrote to his bosses in London to propose what he called a crash program to set up Greater Malaysia if Lee fell from power. So if he fell, they would make a rapid dash into Malaya rather than an orderly and considered process. This was subject to the resolution of the delicate issue of what would happen with the Borneo territories, of course. And his crash program was approved by his superiors in London. The Americans also quietly exerted pressure on Singapore and on the British by making renewal of aid and cooperation programs with Singapore conditional on Lee Kuan Yew staying in power. Lim Chin Siong, of course, had taken Selkirk's admonition at face value. Listeners will remember from episode 40 that Selkirk had told the Barisan that as long as they played by the rules, as long as there was, quote, no infringement of the constitution or resort to direct action of violence, unquote, he would not interfere. And Lim was aware of the Federation's hostility. So he publicly and repeatedly cautioned the Barisan supporters to adhere to constitutional action. Any other choice was suicide. The British had overwhelming military force and were itching to use it against them. Indeed, the British had pointedly refused to rule out its use. So for the Barisan, victory could only be achieved via the court of public opinion. Merger, as the PAP also admitted, could not plausibly occur without the consent of Singapore's people. So that was the Barisan's only play. So to boil down the problem, the Tunku wants the Barisan leaders arrested, but doesn't want to take responsibility because he knows it is not politically justifiable. So he says he wants them arrested before merger. Lee wants the Barisan leaders arrested, but doesn't want to take responsibility because he knows it is not politically justifiable, so he wants them arrested after merger. The British don't mind the Barisan leaders arrested, but don't want to take responsibility because, yes, you guessed it is not politically justifiable, so they are stalling, hoping that an excuse will arise. And the Barisan know all this, which is why Lim Chin Siong is insisting that no matter what happens, we must stick to peaceful constitutional methods so that no excuse will be possible for the PAP or the British or the Federation to carry out arrests. So, we have a Mexican standoff. How would it be resolved? Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture, and I'm PJ Thumb. If you've just joined us, welcome to this week's episode of The History of Singapore, Operation Cold Store Part 1, The Night of Long Knives. Welcome back. One reason that Lord Selkirk used to delay arrests was to argue that any early arrests would delegitimize the passage of the merger legislation through Singapore's Legislative Assembly. As we discussed last week, the debate over the merger white paper and the referendum bill took place on the 20th of November 1961. And after a long, stormy 13-day debate, the PAP used parliamentary procedure to force a vote. The Barisan Socialists, United People's Party and Workers' Party members walked out, whereupon the PAP and Singapore Alliance members who remained approved the white paper. With the legislation passed, the British excuse to delay arrests now expired. You'll remember that back in August, the Tunku had served 6 months' notice for the Federation to leave the Internal Security Council.
On 9th February 1962, with the 6 months' notice looming, the Tunku wrote to the British offering to rescind his withdrawal if the British were prepared to arrest Singapore's political opposition. Privately, Federation officials explained they were making their Internal Security Council membership conditional on the British accepting their demand. They intended to announce this without any warning in order to force Lee Kuan Yew to make his stand clear. Lord Selkirk stalled, arguing that the successful passage of merger legislation showed that Singapore's constitutional process was working. He reminded them that, quote, in the first place, there is no important new evidence of subversive activity on which arrests at this juncture could be justified, unquote. Furthermore, he appointed that arrests now, without Lee's concurrence, would allow him to escape all responsibility, putting all the blame on the Federation and the British. And this last argument was the one which worked. So, accordingly, the Tunku summoned Lee to Kuala Lumpur and told him, look, the arrests have to happen before merger, or merger is off. And Lee, of course, was forced to agree. So, the two of them directed their respective special branches to produce papers which could be used as a basis to justify arrests. And Special Branch Singapore produced a paper describing an extensive communist conspiracy in Singapore, directed from the underground by the MCP and led in the open by Barisan politicians as part of a communist united front. But recognizing that there was no evidence that any of this actually existed, it recommended provocation to force the Barisan leaders to resort to violence, thus providing an excuse for their arrest. The British judged the Special Branch paper as, quote, more as an attack on a political party than on the communists, unquote. By the paper's own admission, it was not a new evaluation of security by Singapore's Special Branch, but an updated version of a Singapore Government Council paper written last August called, quote, the security situation in Singapore as of 1st August 1961. And this paper uncritically cited Lee's Battle for Merger radio speeches as a source. It made assertions without offering proof, and it had several factual errors. This paper was given to the security liaison officer, the MI5 representative in Singapore, Maurice Williams, to evaluate. And he tore apart the paper. He noted numerous major deficiencies. Firstly, he noted, quote, in spite of intensive investigations, no evidence has been obtained of Communist Party of Malaya directions to open United Front workers as to how they should carry out their activities, unquote. The paper's conclusions, he said, were entirely, quote, unquote, surmise. The only politician that Special Branch could prove had worked with the Communist Party in the past few years was Lee Kuan Yew. Secondly, the paper argued that having the same goal as the communists made someone a communist sympathizer, which was really a silly assertion. I mean, the communists wanted Merdeka. The Barisan wanted Merdeka. PAP wanted Merdeka. Everyone wanted Merdeka. That does not mean that the Barisan, the PAP, and everyone are communists. Thirdly, noting the massive breadth and scale of activities attributed to this alleged communist united front, Williams pointed out that, quote, it was inconceivable that Special Branch investigations would have failed to yield any evidence of such control and direction, unquote, of a conspiracy of such huge scale. And finally, he noted, the label Communist United Front was so broadly applied that it referred to anyone unhappy of the government, quote, united only in their dissatisfaction with the PAP government, and they cannot be considered to form a monolithic communist edifice under strict party management, unquote. Thus, he concluded, quote, the developments since August 1961 outlined in the paper do not support this conclusion, unquote, stated in the Special Branch paper. He continued, quote, the part played by the MCP or any other Communist Party in this process is not known and can merely be surmised, but it can be stated with some confidence that whether or not the Barisan Socialists could obtain power by constitutional means, there is no Communist Party organization in Singapore capable of assuming political power in its own right, unquote. And so he concluded by strongly advising against repression. You'll remember from episode 30, Pa Mata, that in 1956, the police commissioner, Alan Blades, recommended arresting anyone who acted in a communist manner. Yet now Blades himself was, quote, taken aback by the lack of evidence of subversion in the Singapore Special Branch paper, unquote. Philip Moore believed, quote, Lim Chin Siong is working very much on his own, and his primary objective is not the communist millennium, but to obtain control of the constitutional government of Singapore. In Singapore today, we have a political and not a security problem, unquote. And Lord Selkirk concurred, quote, Singapore's special branch have virtually failed to identify directly any communists during the last 3 years. Evidence on which to base repressive action is therefore almost totally lacking, unquote. And indeed, most of the PAP agreed. When the British privately showed Toh Chin Chai the special branch paper, Toh was shocked by its recommendations and made clear his opposition. He was personally against repression. He believed it was tactically foolish. They were winning. Why screw it up by resorting to unnecessary and unfounded arrests? Furthermore, he said, the majority of the PAP was opposed to repressive action unless necessary to maintain law and order. Toh explained that a leak of the paper would not only split the party, it might split the cabinet. As PAP chairman, Toh Chin Chai had the difficult task of holding the party together. PAP unity had just been badly shaken by another defection to the Barisan and might not take another controversial decision. He begged the British to stand firm against arrests, but also to keep his views secret from Lee and Goh Keng Swee. The British readily concurred, as they also believed that the main danger of Lee's collapse lay in the further disintegration of PAP unity on disagreements over issues of principle or merger or declining morale, not from the Barisan or any security issue. The real threat is Lee Kuan Yew. The real problem, Selkirk felt, was that, quote, Lee Kuan Yew is quite clearly attracted by the prospect of wiping out his main political opposition before the next Singapore election, unquote. And so for Lee, the only questions on the arrest was their timing. When confronted with the special branch paper, Lee claimed that he played no part in its production, a claim that was met with great scepticism by the British. So much for finding evidence for arrest then. But the Federation leaders were not dissuaded. The Tunku continued to demand a formal reply to his 9th February letter threatening withdrawal from the council. The British could not give one without either triggering an official Federation withdrawal from the council or committing to arrests. So this problem was placed in abeyance by the simple expediency of not replying to his letter and indefinitely postponing the next meeting of the Internal Security Council. And in the meantime, they just avoided taking decisions that would need the endorsement of the council. In the meantime, the Federation and Singapore governments proceeded on their own with their plan to provoke the Barisan into unconstitutional action. Despite its own paper, Singapore's special branch was reluctant, but after, quote, strong political pressure, unquote, it concurred with its Federation counterpart and so commenced a campaign of harassment against newspapers, publications, trade unions, and opposition politicians. In particular, the police harassed opposition politicians, followed them around, broke up legitimate meetings, refused permits to legal events, sent warning letters to publications. And these had no legal basis. Philip Moore reported that it seems that legal basis for all this action is shaky, and that the PAP were determined to keep up the pressure, but that Lim Chin Siong is not going to be provoked into any action which could give the government good reason for making arrests. The Federation leaders and Lee Kuan Yew realised that there was no chance of the British officials in Singapore agreeing to the arrest. Philip Moore and Lord Selkirk were very firm. Evidence or no arrest. So they decided, Lee and the Federation leaders decided to go above Lord Selkirk to their bosses in London. So they were due in London for negotiations on merger, and they also used that opportunity to press for arrests. And they were disappointed. In London, in May 1962, Lee Kuan Yew met with Secretary of State for the Colonies, Reginald Maudling, and pressed him on the question of arrest. And Maudling listened politely but maintained no action could be taken unless he was convinced it would improve the situation. And when he met Prime Minister Harold Macmillan, Lee was subject to probing questioning and was finally forced to admit that the Barisan leaders were merely stooges and not actually leading communists themselves, and that the trade unions were no more communist than the electrical trades union in Britain, that is, not controlled by the communists and functioning chiefly as a left-wing pressure group. But circumstances could change rapidly, and they did. On the 13th of July 1962, Harold Macmillan suddenly reshuffled his cabinet and dismissed seven people, one-third of the cabinet. And this event would be remembered as the Night of Long Knives. Secretary of State for the Colonies, Reginald Maudling, was promoted to Chancellor of the Exchequer. Secretary of State for Commonwealth Relations, Duncan Sands, was given the additional responsibility of the Colonial Office. One man holding the joint post would reduce the infighting between the two ministries. Now, Sands would not hold the post long. The Conservatives would lose power in the 1964 election. But for the 2 years that he held the two posts, he made a critical difference, not least to the future of the people of Malaysia. Because as Secretary of State for Commonwealth Relations, Sands had put a lot of effort into creating Malaysia, and he was not going to allow it to fail. He was a military man. He had fewer qualms about the use of force. But perhaps most importantly, he did not have a good relationship with Lord Selkirk. As fate would have it, he would develop a great relationship with Lee Kuan Yew. Maudling had trusted Selkirk and politely resisted Lee. Sands would undermine Selkirk and put his faith in Lee. And so, in late July 1962, the new colonial and Commonwealth Secretary Duncan Sands met with the Tunku, Tun Razak and Lee Kuan Yew. Before the meeting, Lord Selkirk wrote a personal letter to Sands, pleading with him not to be manipulated by the Federation leaders and Lee. His letter is worth reading here, if only to convey how astonishingly emotional it is. Lord Selkirk wrote, quote, "The Malayan government again talk of neutralizing communists in Singapore before Malaysia. There is, however, neither agreement nor clarity in what is intended. The Malays talk of arresting 25 for security reasons. Lee Kuan Yew talks of arresting 250 for security and political reasons. In fact, I believe both of them wish to arrest the effective political opposition and blame us for doing so. I must leave you in no doubt how dangerous I think this policy is for the following reasons. One, arbitrary arrests without convincing public proof must strengthen the opposition in Singapore and disturb Lee's colleagues, possibly causing him to fall. Two, it would become abundantly clear that Malaysia was being imposed by the British, regardless of the will of the people involved. It will then be presented as our plan for preserving our bases, with the Tunku allowing himself to be used as our stooge. And three, it will be very difficult to defend action of this character in Parliament here or in the United Nations, where the Russians are known to be working hard against Malaysia." And he continued, quote, "Nor has any solid argument been advanced why such action as may be necessary for security could not be taken by the Malaysian government after the formation of Malaysia," unquote. Indeed, Selkirk actually writes that, quote, "We can undertake to deliver Singapore to the Tunku peacefully and in good order as long as we avoid stupid actions such as indiscriminate arrest of left-wing politicians." And so he writes, quote, "I recommend that we tell the Malays we cannot support the policy of arresting left-wing politicians unless they resort to illegal measures or at least can be shown to go well beyond legitimate parliamentary opposition," unquote. It's quite amazing that Selkirk got so emotional he actually called the arrest stupid. It shows just how much he thought they were uncalled for and how desperate he was to stop them. But I need to make one point clear here. Selkirk was not saying he was against arrests because they were morally wrong. Selkirk was not making a moral stand. He was making a political one, arguing that arrests would be against British interests. He was saying that Britain could have Malaysia without taking unnecessary risks. As I have mentioned before, to the end, Selkirk was a loyal soldier of Britain. But it was to no avail. It's clear that Sands had already made up his mind. And so, in his meeting with the Tunku Tun Razak and Lee Kuan Yew, Sands carefully mapped out the path forward. Sands said he could not be, quote, put in a position where he could be said to have agreed in advance, even in principle, to a series of arrests in Singapore without having considered the cases of the individuals concerned. But if the Internal Security Council decided the arrests were necessary, he would not intervene. Each individual case had to be made out and examined on its merits. If everyone else was prepared to take their share of responsibility, then the British government would not shirk theirs. Lee Kuan Yew asked him, wait, what about Selkirk? Selkirk's opposed to the arrest. And Sands replied, quote, you must leave me to deal with my representative, unquote. And Lee pressed Sands to concede that there was an internal security threat in Singapore. And Sands very carefully replied, quote, I do not know about any subversive threat as such, unquote, but added, quote, you may find my performance better than it is today, unquote. It was agreed that Lee and the Federation and the British would together put together cases for unanimous agreement by the Internal Security Council, and that the arrest would occur after Singapore's referendum and after the Malaysia Bill debate in the UK Parliament, which was scheduled for February 1963. So it is clear then from this point, evidence or no evidence, the arrests were going to happen. Indeed, we know today there was never any evidence. Those cases that the Internal Security Council wrote up are now declassified and available to be viewed at the National Archives of the United Kingdom. So you can see for yourself clearly, there is no evidence. And I know the issue of whether the arrests were justified is a controversial one. It remains a topic of fierce debate today. But I need to stress this point. Even the fiercest critics, people who have written entire books arguing that the arrests were justified, concede that there was no evidence on which to base Lim Chin Siong's arrest or the arrest of his Barisan colleagues. Because of the simple fact that if there ever was evidence, then the British would have arrested them all in a heartbeat and put them on trial and convicted them and sent them away for a long time. The use of detention without trial was necessary because there was no evidence. Every historian agrees on this point. Whether or not the arrests were justified and necessary for Singapore is a separate issue. So this was a political decision, not a security decision. And with the decision made, the next question then was who to arrest and when. But as if to underscore the political nature of these arrests, these questions of who and when would be bitterly disputed to the point where arrests would be delayed for months, where relationships would break down between the Federation, British and Singapore leaders, to the point where Malaysia nearly doesn't happen, where it nearly all falls apart. And the funny thing is, all this because of an event that happened far away in Britain. The internal politics of the Conservative Party would have a transformative and permanent impact on Singapore's future. The poor relationship between one man and his representative in Singapore would have a transformative and permanent impact on Singapore's future. On such luck and coincidence, do the wheels of history turn. The story continues next week. Join us then. As always, if you have any questions, comments or feedback, please email me at thehistoryofsingapore@gmail.com or visit my webpage at thehistoryofsingapore.com. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit Patreon, patreon.com/pjfam. Thank you very much and see you next week. This has been The History of Singapore, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.